Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
It's wonderful to see you. How is the weather in Colorado? It seems really bizarre.
Well, so 2 days ago it was nice and hot, but smoky. And then it snowed like crazy. And then yesterday it melted, but we still have 3 snowmen in the yard. I noticed that they haven't melted yet, but it's just crazy.
It really is bizarre. Yesterday was the first decent day we've had here since June. It was down to a cold 97, which for us was miraculous.
That's just too hot.
It really is. But you know, what's really unnerving is that the color of the sky and the sun from California. We got up yesterday and the sun was bright orange. Yes. Early in the morning. So
and then this makes the sunsets very creepy, I think. And I don't know if you saw yesterday the photos from the Bay Area where it just looks like they were on Mars. I mean, the whole sky was orange.
I did see that. So how long have you been in Colorado instead of Los Angeles?
Since June. We came up at the beginning of June. And it snowed right when we got here, and we're about to go home, so it snowed to send us out.
How wonderful. So what have you been doing? Are you writing? I assume that you are.
I've been writing. I should have a pile of book around here somewhere. But when I got here, I had just turned in the new book, and then it took a while for my editor to read it. And then I've been doing actually pretty major revision, which I finished over the weekend, and on Tuesday started back on page 1.
Wow. So can you give us any kind of a hint about what it's about, or do you want it to stay quiet?
No, I'm happy to talk about it. So, you know, I do think about books for a really long time. I mean, you know, 10, 20 years sometimes, but this one, 26 years. And 26 years ago, when my grandmother passed away, I found in her belongings a diary written by her mother, so my great-grandmother, who was born on a homestead in South Dakota. The family continued west, homesteaded in Washington State. She got pregnant very young and had to get married. And so she and her husband, my great-grandfather, they had very hard lives. I think of the characters, you know, the fictional characters I've written who have had really hard lives, but nothing like this. They just had really tough lives, and they were itinerant workers from Alaska down to the Mexican border. And so, you know, I think on the surface, this seems very different from any of my other books. It's the first one that's really, you know, 100% American. And, but to me, it fits right in with what I've been trying to do, which is tell these stories of history, but through the eyes of women. And so can I just tell you two more things about it? Just two more. So one is this idea of moving west, you know, this such an American story, this westward migration, and the idea of you go into the frontier, you pioneer, you settle, you move on to the next frontier, pioneer and settle and move on to the next. So this west, 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 until all of a sudden you smack up against the Pacific Ocean and it's like, now what? And clearly my great-grandparents didn't figure out the answer. And because they kept going up and down and up and down, but it's still, you know, it's something that's still going on today where you see all these people still coming west, west, you know, Washington, or I mean, the whole west, but Washington, Oregon, California, and then they get California and it's like, well, now what? You know, it's not like it's cracked up to be necessarily. And then the other is that we think we live in a time of tremendous change, and you know, of course we do, but not like this time period that I'm writing about, where you go, and it's short, you know, where you go from true pioneer living to having indoor plumbing, electricity, telephones, radio, movies, no television yet, bicycles coming on big, automobiles, airplanes, and then in a sort of more historical level, World War I, the last big pandemic, prohibition and a woman's right to vote, which of course we just had the 100th anniversary last week, I guess it was. And so all of this happens in this very, very condensed time period. And until about 6 months ago, I could say all but one of those have an impact on us today. And now I can say just every single one.
Remarkable. And, you know, I often think about the beginning of the 19th century when the Industrial Revolution was just kicking underway. And the British and the French were fighting a 25-year war and nobody, 20-year war. Nobody knew how it would come out until Waterloo. So, you know, you can read Jane Austen and other Regency sort of style books and not realize just
what's going on
over there. Well, yeah, that was part of it. But there was still a constant fear of invasion. It wasn't really any different than it was in World War II in the sense of imminent invasion and how would we stop it. But yet when we read about it with a glass of history, because we know how it came out, it doesn't seem as traumatic. So, you know, I used to think, because I was born in 1940, and I used to congratulate myself on having missed the 1930s. And here it is, you know, all over again with so many of the same forces going on. And I thought, how ironic to get, you know, to the senior part of my life and be plunged into the part that I was always happy I missed.
But didn't you, I mean, I felt this with my father, who actually was born in 1930, I think, and my mother was born in 34. But you know, and then I had all my grandparents, but I always felt that even I had sort of grown up with it, you know, that they carried so much from those days of frugality and where do you keep your money and, you know, don't throw that out, all those kinds of things that, especially like for my mother and father who were just tiny, really, I guess my father got to be there for the whole thing, but still is, you know, a baby for part of it, that it had a real impact on them. And I think that those impacts, you know, you sort of saw, at least I felt like I sort of experienced second and then even third hand, you know, some of the consequences of living day to day with a depression.
Absolutely. It shaped both of my parents. My father, at the age of 12, went up in the summers to work in the wheat fields of North Dakota for some pitiful wage. And mm-hmm. he was an all-American tackle. So in his day, playing on Northwestern's undefeated till the final game, Big Ten championship football team, when they listed everybody else, they listed their height and weight. And when they got to daddy, they just said heavyweight because he was like a 300 pound, 6 foot something tackle. But he had these enormous legs and his torso was too long for his legs, which made him great as a football player because you couldn't really knock him down. But the medical verdict was that he had stunted his growth by all this hard work at this very young age and that he should have been much taller and, you know, and his leg length should have matched the rest of him, but it intervened. And, you know, all his life, he lived to be 81 and my mother lived to be 95. They were indeed shaped by, you know, childhood because he was born in 14, she was born in 1917, having lived through the Depression, yeah. You know, and the war years and whatever. And I think they would really be both at home at the moment and yet deeply shocked by the political divisions because, you know, there was more of a community spirit and pulling together, I think, than we are currently experiencing.
We were just talking about that last night. We were just talking about that whole idea of pulling together and, you know, when things are really down. I mean, I'm sure it happens in every country, but I think that's traditionally been part of our American story of how we pull, you know, when things are tough, we pull together. And I just really am not seeing that right now.
No, but we have a history of individualism. I mean, that's been one of our ideals. And unfortunately, it's not serving us well at the moment. And the other problem is that the internet allows these little groups to get together. I mean, I remember being really shocked by the discovery that bulimics could gather together on the internet and give each other hints about how to, you know, defeat medical personnel and how to, you know, keep going and if forcibly hospitalized and all. And I thought, wow, you know, that is such a bad thing. And, you know, it's like this QAnon stuff. I mean, you know, if you just had a few people scattered around that were off the charts, it wasn't so bad. But now when they can band together, it's completely different.
Yeah.
So it's the other thing I found really interesting, Rob and I are addicted to MHZ TV, which is a channel that does mostly foreign movies, and they have tons of
And what's it called again?
It's called Amazon Mary, H as in Harry, Z as in Zebra. And you can get to it through Amazon Fire Stick and whatever. But we've watched it for ages because they have fabulous French mystery. I mean, they have some great stuff, but they also have like Icelandic and Finland, and we're currently watching one set in Northern Sweden. So they're up among the Sami and Lapland. And we watched something in Australia. And in every one of those countries, we are seeing racism. We are seeing, you know, in indigenous peoples in Australia, you know, a terrible problem. In Sweden, the Sami have the same problem. And so, you know, it's not just America where we are dealing with all these questions of diversity and cultures and racism. Is actually a worldwide problem. But I think that it is accelerated because of the way people can form Facebook groups or whatever it is. So, you know, for a novelist, it's a terrific time, even if it's hard to live through as an actual person.
Yeah, I'll just tell you, we have been watching Finnish television shows, you know, binge watching. And I don't know, I just never really thought about Finland as being, you know, a great producer of television, you know, just because I'm so ignorant. But these are fabulous shows. And I have to say, I think that that's one of the benefits of sheltering in place and not going out, is that we've really explored a lot of other cultures actually through their television shows and also film, but mostly these sort of long form series that are just, you know, you can watch for weeks, you know, before you have to move on.
Did you catch one called Border Town?
That's what we have two episodes left.
I thought it was absolutely fabulous, and I will tell
fantastic.
You, well, I mean, the good news, because the lead, who I think is absolutely wonderful, he is the pathologist in a Swedish series that we're watching called, I'm going to have to think of it, Rebecca Martinson. And to our amazement, he pops
that's
up.
The name of the series?
Yep, Rebecca. All right, it's on MHC. It's written by a Swedish author called Asa, A-S-A Larsson, L-A-R-S-S-O-N, I think. I never can do the Swedish vowels correctly. And I fell in love with him. I thought he was fabulous. And
I love him.
Yeah, he's a chain-smoking lung cancer pathologist working in the Sami.
And then the name of the show?
It's called Rebecca, R-E-B-E-C-C-A, Martinson, M-A-R-T-I-N-S-S-O-N.
Okay.
And I've seen the books. In fact, I think I've read a couple of them. And oddly enough, they changed the lead character, Rebecca, who's a lawyer, a prosecutor, in season two, because we finished season one, they recast her, which was unnerving. But everybody else, including the lead in Border Town. But you know what's fabulous among all the other things is the scenery. I've been to Finland. I've been to Finland twice. And the first time we went, we were doing a cruise around the Baltic, and it was like it gave you whiplash because you were in Sweden, where the traditional enemy was Russia or Finland or the Nazis or Norway over here. And then you went to Finland, and for Finland, the traditional enemy was Sweden to the west, Russia to the east. Then we were in Russia, you know, for a long time, and it was the same. And so as you circled around the Baltic, we're so Eurocentric, you know, regular Eurocentric. I never really thought about all the shifting alliances and enemies that you would find in the Baltic ringing countries. But Finland is a real pivot because of its location between Russia and Sweden and Norway. And then, of course, going north, you know, you don't realize that the Sami are basically like the indigenous people in Alaska and across the top of Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things I have found fascinating about Bordertown is just that relationship to Russia, mm-hmm. and how the woman Lena, you know, came out and worked for the FSB and now is here in Finland, but those ties, and also such a porous border, you know, that people are going back and forth all the time without thinking much about it, but it's obviously there's nefarious things going on.
Well, there really are. I wish there would be a season 4 now that the wife is not in the picture, and see what would happen between him and Lena. But anyway.
I'm ready for that.
Well, I'll tell you what.
She's difficult. You know, she's such a good actor, she could have somebody melt her heart a little bit.
She could. And I think it's a fascinating woman. There's also a great series set in Reykjavik, which Rob and I liked a lot. So I'll send you the link to that, because if you've done Finland, you might as well do Iceland.
And then there's the other one. I can't remember what it was called. I just can't remember, but I'll look it up and I'll send that to you, where it's also in Finland, but it's a woman detective with a lot of problems. So woman detective with serious emotional issues, but she's, you know, brilliant. And that one, the whole series was filmed in the winter. So, but with Bordertown, there were the first two seasons were in the summer, I guess, summer or spring, sometime when you could see green. And then of course this last season has been all in the snow, but there, you know, for somebody who grew up in Southern California and is not terribly familiar with that kind of weather, I'm happy to watch it. And especially when it's been so hot, there's something kind of wonderful about seeing all these people with all their stuff all over them.
Absolutely. We did a train trip up into Lapland, which was absolutely fascinating. And discovered there are 450 different notches that you cut into reindeer ear, which is the way they brand the herds to belong to different people. So it's amazing the interesting stuff that you pick up. But let's go back to your book. Do you know a writer named Sandra Dallas?
No.
Well, I'm going to introduce you to Sandra, because she writes about women going west. And very much the sort of books, the themes that you're talking about in your book. In fact, there's a video that I did with her. I'll send you the link. And her last book was called Westering Women. And it was about women moving towards, I think it's Oregon rather than California, but the basic trail is the same. But she's been writing about women and how they've tried to carve lives for themselves, overcoming different circumstances. She had a bestseller some 20 years ago called The Persian Pickle Club, which is one of my all-time favorite books. I mean, it's really fabulous. So I will introduce you to Sandra, because I think that you would find a real affinity to her work. And interestingly enough, she lives in Colorado, so what a shame that you're going home just at the wrong time. All right, so have you been hiking? I know you and your husband are serious hikers.
Oh, yeah, we've been hiking like mad. But actually, you know, working 5 days a week, so we're just really mostly hiking on the weekends. Last weekend, we did an 8-mile round trip up to 11,700 and some feet on the to American Lake. And I think my body's still recovering, but we love to hike, and it's wonderful to be outside. And people have been very careful here. You know, they had a big outbreak. They were one of the hot spots at the very beginning of the pandemic. So they completely shut down. I mean, really shut down everything, the airport, everything for a few months. And so that's one of the reasons why we've been felt, pretty, we'll just say relatively safe here, because they actually do have contact tracing and all those things that they say you need to have. And my grandson actually has started school here, because they have in-person school. So my son and his family will be staying here for the next year, at least.
Wow. Well, I know that we have talked in the past about Peru, for example, which is a hiking paradise. And
Chile. Patagonia. Chile,
right. So you ended up going there, didn't you?
We went, yeah, you sent us all the stuff about Peru, and then we ended up going to Chile, and we loved that trip. That's one of my favorite places I've ever been.
So when you were in Chile, where were you? Were you near Santiago, or were you over east?
Well, we flew through, obviously flew through Santiago, because got to go, you know, through a major airport. And we were there for a couple of days, and then we went down, we went to the Atacama Desert, which is the highest, driest place on Earth. And, you know, that's a, sort of more towards the north of the country. And then way to the bottom to Patagonia, where we were for several days and did just unbelievable hiking. I mean, just, it was just incredible. But we stayed at a lodge that's the only hotel inside the Torres del Paine Park. And so just, you know, you could just sit in bed and look at this view that just changed every 5 minutes with the weather. I mean, just, I've never seen anything like it. It just didn't even look real, you know, just because it was so stunning and again, changed so much. And then we went to the Argentinian side of Patagonia and went out on the big glaciers and hiked on the glaciers. And then where did we go from there? And then we went to Buenos Aires, and then we ended our trip in a little tiny fishing village. We always feel like on these kinds of trips, we need a vacation from our vacation. So we always try to find some place where we can just be on a beach for about 4 days and do absolutely nothing except drink and swim and read books. And so we did that, but I don't remember exactly where that was. And then we came home.
It sounds wonderful. So I've only been to Torre del Paine for the day, and we had lunch at that lodge. But did you hike, sort of circumnavigate Torre del Paine when you were there? Because you
know, there's a W, right? I mean, there's and people usually do one length of the W one day, and so they camp. We had some bad weather, so we only did one length of the W, so we definitely want to go back and do all of it. but because of the hotel, we can, you know, get on the boat and go back to the hotel each night. But we also did other hikes just all throughout the area. So we were out every day. There was just one day of very bad weather. And then in that particular hotel at the end of the evening, after dinner, all of the different guides for bicycling, hiking, horseback riding, they all come and you sort of wander from group to group and figure out what you want to do the next day. So they tell you, like, here are the, you know, if you're interested in horseback riding, go talk to those people. We have the half day, we have the full day, we have the beginning, you know, for people who are beginners and people who are expert horseback riders. And then they do the same for hiking and biking. So they have all kinds of things. You can mix them up. It was great.
It sounds wonderful. Rob and I were going to hike the Inca Trail some years ago. And as we were in the lodge getting ready to hike in to Machu Picchu, which is a 2 or 3 day hike and all, that was the year that the rains were so torrential that the Urubamba flooded and cut off Machu Picchu. And so we had just about started on the trail when they closed it. So we went back to Cusco for a week, and every day they would fly a helicopter to Machu Picchu to try to rescue a few of the people who had been totally stranded. You know, a lot of people died on the trail because of the mudslides, because the Andes are not really rock, they're mud. They're a different mountain range than our Rockies, and they're subject to terrible mudslides in heavy rain and so forth. So we were grateful that we stopped before we got there, because, you know, it would have been terrible. But what was so fascinating is when the helicopter would come back and land and people would get off, because it's such a tiny hotel at Machu Picchu, it was completely unprepared for a lot of people to be stranded there. And, you know, there wasn't enough water and there wasn't enough food and people hadn't had showers and, you know, they were all cranky. But the thing that would bug them the most was that none of them had taken anything to read. And the few people that had like a Kindle, it died, you know, there was no power. And so you had all these really grumpy, dirty, hungry, but basically bored people coming off. And I think they could only take like 30 a day because the helicopter was damaging to the ruins. They had to find a landing pad for it because they're not allowed. Normally, the only way you get to Machu Picchu is to take the train or hike in. And so they could only evacuate these small numbers of people. But it was so interesting to me that their primary complaint was a lack of anything to read.
Yeah,
it's like a business opportunity.
During these, it was a business opportunity. You only brought five cases of books with you. So, are you finding people are reading a lot now? I talk to a lot of book clubs on Zoom, but I'm just finding that people are reading like crazy.
And they are reading, Lisa, and it's interesting how many people have gone back to classics or tackled books that maybe they never would have read, like, you know, Back to War and Peace or something.
Yeah.
We're not a general bookstore, although, I mean, we become one over time. I mean, we started as a mystery store years ago just to differentiate ourselves from Barnes & Noble, but we're going to be 31 on October 3rd, so there's been a big evolution. We don't have room to stock the whole universe of books. But what's been fascinating is watching what people order on our website. And because they can order anything, it doesn't matter, and we obtain it for them. And every day when I do a restock report, I'm completely fascinated by the special orders that, you know, and what's been frustrating for a lot of people is they've tried to order books that are no longer in print. Not classics, but maybe like early books in series or something. And, you know, published in 2009 or 2013. Mm-hmm. And the way publishing works anymore, there's a fairly short shelf life for a lot. I mean, you've done so well that all of your books have remained in print. But for many authors,
a lot of them fell out of print. And then, you know, when I had Snowflower and the Secret Fan, my then publisher bought up the books that had been out of print. But even those, you know, those, I guess that's two of the mysteries that they, one they already had, and then the two that were out of print. But they did those, I think, only electronically. So they didn't have to really invest anything, you know, and they just sell at a nice little steady clip, but it didn't really cost them anything to do that. But I think if you're still producing a real book, you know, you've got to store it and, you know, warehouse it and all of those things. But I find it fascinating because during this time, you know, I talk to a lot of book clubs. I always have. But people are going back to the old books. You know, I'm actually on Friday, I'm talking to, what's the organization? Historic Shanghai. So this, you know, is a group in Shanghai and they're reading Dreams of Joy. And I don't have a copy with me. So I hope they don't ask me questions that are too tough. I talked to another group the other day that had read The Interior, one, the second of the mysteries. And, you know, I probably haven't talked about that book since it came out in 1997. And they were saying, well, what about so-and-so? And, you know, and I was like, who's that? You know, some character. And I was like, who is that? I don't remember that character. But it has been kind of fun to revisit some of these older books, instead of just the, you know, the one that's the most recent. When you go out on tour and you talk about it, you know, over and over again throughout the day, and then maybe there's like a year or two to talk about that particular book, but then you move on to the next one. But this one, I feel like I've been going down memory lane.
Well, I'm sure you have. We always keep your three mysteries in stock. I've given up nagging you about writing another one because I know you've gone off in another direction, but I thought they were absolutely fabulous.
Well, you never know. You know, I have the one that I'm finishing. I thought I knew what the next book was going to be, but to do the research for that would require a very difficult trip deep, 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 deep into the interior of China. There's no way I can do that now. So I have been thinking a little closer to home And I have had an idea for a mystery for a long time that would take place in Los Angeles Chinatown. So, you know, that I don't have to go anywhere to do the research. I mean, I can just drive around if I need to, but a lot of that is sort of just my own personal memories and things I already know. So I feel like I could do that research pretty easily. Anyway, we'll see. I have to get the new one
done first. And then we'll see.
I'll have to just kind of see what I can do, because, you know, my books, even the mysteries, are so research heavy. You know, the ones that took place in China, you know, I did a research trip for each one of those. And I just can't do that now, right now, at least until there's a vaccine.
No, you can't. I know they're research heavy. I think I told you that some years ago, the Phoenix Art Museum did a had a Chinese exhibit of various things, and they had the Ryu, the, you know, mm-hmm. And that's a big part of your third mystery. It was Flower Net and then the interior, and now I'm forgetting the title.
Dragon Bones.
Right. And so, you know, I think one of the great values of those mysteries, and I think a great value of mysteries in general, is all the cool stuff you can learn.
Exactly.
As a reader without going into it. I mean, you know, I love your book about the Pu'er Ti, for example. I mean, I think that's one of my, you know, most of the Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane is one of my all-time.
Oh, I'm drinking some right now.
There you are. I'm doing Earl Grey, which is far more boring. But anyway, and I meant to tell you, and I'll try to find the link, but I just ran across a new book coming out that is set on your Korean island.
Really?
Yep. And I was fascinated because, I mean, World War II is like a gift that never stops giving for authors. And, you know, I never even thought about, is it Jeju? I don't know how to pronounce it.
Jeju, yeah, just
Jeju. Okay, I never even heard of it, let alone thought about it until, you know, we did the event for your book. And I was fascinated by it. And then I saw that and I thought, okay, Lisa has now brought this, you know, to everybody's attention. And I bet we're going to see more books that are set in that.
You know, the thing about World War II as the gift that keeps on giving, there, every year, you know how many books, whether they're historical fiction or mysteries or, you know, spy novels, whatever they get to take, even romances that take place in Europe during World War II. But there's still the whole war in the Pacific. Yes, there's some books, and yes, there are a few films, and but really, it's not in the popular culture the way the war in Europe was and continues to be. And so there's so many stories from World War II that take place in the Pacific that we just really don't know, or, you know, barely heard, like a little tiny thing, but, you know, it just wasn't part of our education. And it's also just not an area that has traditionally been explored through film, movies, television, I mean, film, books, television. So I think there's a lot there. And then in the case of Jeju, you know, this historically was seen as a stepping stone for other countries to, you know, invade and then use that as a stepping stone to get to another country. So it was its own independent kingdom for about 1,000 years, but then you have, you know, the Manchus and also the Mongols who came in and kept the island for centuries and used that to invade Japan and other countries Korea all around. And then of course Japan had it and used that to as a stepping stone to invade China and all through the Pacific on, you know, December 7th for in the United States, but because of the dateline, the rest of Asia basically on December 8th. And then it was seen as this final, what would you call it? You know, like our the last stand for the Japanese. So when the tide of war started to shift, they knew what was coming. They had a sense, oh, I guess we're gonna lose. And so the estimates are 250,000 Japanese troops on this one island, and almost all of them underground because it's a volcanic island. So lots of caves, lava tubes. And the belief was when the United States came, they were going to invade through Jeju to get to Japan. And of course, that's not how it turned out. You know, we dropped the bomb instead, but they were really prepared for this final showdown on Jeju, which again, you know, the idea of a quarter of a million people underground waiting for an invasion is pretty interesting, I think.
It's fascinating. And that was such a horrible calculation to try to decide where the greater loss of life and so forth would be, to actually go through hand-to-hand combat all the way into Japan or to drop the bomb. I've always been interested that Harry Truman never seemed to lose any sleep over it. He made what he thought was the right decision, you know, to save lives. And, you know, he probably did actually save lives despite the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I've been to both of them several times. I've traveled a lot in Japan, and Nagasaki was not, the radiation was terrible, but the destruction, because Nagasaki is a whole series of valleys and canyons and so forth. So the destructive force of the bomb was dispersed, whereas Hiroshima is flat and it just, you know, eradicated it. But and I never went to Hiroshima to see the monument. I just didn't want to do that, but there are other things around Hiroshima. But I think we often think that Nagasaki was the same as Hiroshima in terms of what happened there, but quite different. But you're absolutely right. And there are stories about, you know, Singapore and Malaysia and Kuala Lumpur and, you know, the Philippines. I can't even think of if there's any World War II book about, you know, I mean, right now it's all Paris all the time, you know.
Exactly.
It really is. It's just unbelievable about Paris and, you know, two track stories. And in the movies, you know, there's the bridge on the River Kwai, and I can't think of anything else in the Burma theater, which was fascinating. And now the Burmese are back, you know, Rob and I took the first commercial trip down the Irrawaddy from Mandalay to Yangon, although I keep calling it Rangoon. And it was fascinating because the Irrawaddy is a very shallow draft river. And so even the little boats would get stuck, and then they would have to like call for a tugboat. And I remember sitting there, they had a little espresso thing on top of this little wooden boat that we are on. And I remember everyone else was just bitching all day long about how we were tied to a tree. You know, we couldn't move because we were on a sandbag. We were tied to a tree and waiting for the tugboats. And I had this fabulous book. And so I was up there drinking coffee and reading my book and having the most wonderful day. And everyone else was going, you know, just going mad with boredom. And
another lesson of why you need to bring good books on a trip.
You know, totally true. And you know, not a Kindle. I mean, a real book where you can keep reading it, whatever happens to you is a great thing. But anyhow, you know, I realized then that there are all kinds of stories about Burma that nobody has told about Burma in the war. And even in Thailand, which was like Sweden and stayed neutral, there were still, you know, things that went on. And, you know, India was a major theater, Burma was a major theater, and Thailand is kind of, you know, in a sense, like Sweden and even Finland, caught between big countries that were at war, but trying to stay neutral. So I'm sure there will be novels to come. And I'm not sure where this vogue about Paris-based World War II stories has come from, but I mean, there must be like 30 books in the store that are all set in World War II Paris.
Well, I mean, who doesn't like Paris, I guess? You know, I mean, I think people love Paris just right there. And then they love Paris. I mean, they love France. And I think also because there's some interesting things with the Vichy government and how all of that worked, you know, going back to television again. Early in the pandemic, we watched all the seasons of, what is it, The French Village, A French Village.
Right.
And which again, we loved, and it was set in that time period, but it was not Paris, but in a little tiny village. And it was really quite fascinating. Some good people, some bad people, but to see how that all worked, you know, the idea of collaborators, you know, and people who may have started out thinking, I'm actually helping my village or my town or my arrondissement by collaborating, but that turns pretty quickly, you know, and then people don't forget it or forgive it either.
Very true. Well, Frances always had a deeply anti-Semitic streak, which, you know, you want to go all the way back to Dreyfus and even earlier. So that there are a lot of divisions within France that make it, I think, a fascinating country to read about, and the war exacerbated them. But, you know, they had that whole thing with Germany for three major wars. They had the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, and then we had World War I, and then World War II. Rob and I took a trip into the Chateau country some years ago. And, you know, there's a, I'm trying to remember what it is with Chateau, but there's a bridge, and that was the gateway between occupied France and free France. If you could make it to the bridge, and I think it's also, and go across, you know, you were in free France. And there have been a couple of really good books about, set in Lisbon, because Portugal was another neutral country, but fascist by leaning. And so, you know, there are some books set in Portugal and Spain about the war. Robert Wilson wrote a really brilliant book. Wish I could remember the name of it. His Lisbon in the title. And then unfortunately, you know, probably has fallen out of print. But I think, you know, the Asian theater has been seriously overlooked. I agree with you. And it would be interesting to read a lot more about it. But I'm excited that you might be writing a mystery of Los Angeles, because then I could go back and get the mysteries, because they're actually all available through print on demand. They're not just digital.
They are.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it really doesn't matter that they're produced on demand. They're still, you know.
No, you can still get them. Yeah. Yes, and they have much nicer jackets now. You know, I remember when they first sent them to me, and I, in the new version, I was like, well, if these books had these nice jackets originally, they might have sold more.
Yeah, well, you know, selling, of course, is part of publishing, so you can't really. But I've always been glad that, aside from the fact that it was such a wonderful book and good for you, but I was always thrilled that Snowflower became a bestseller. And so it gave publishers an interest in keeping your earlier books alive. So I sent you a book, which I hope you will enjoy, called 50 Words for Rain, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, I hasn't gotten here yet, but I can't wait for it to arrive, because I need a new book to read. So
we sent it UPS. It hasn't arrived yet?
Well, let me put it to the this. I have to go to the post office to get it. So I mean, it may be sitting in the post office, and I just haven't gone there yet. But I haven't gotten it. I mean, you know, we just don't go to the post office every single day.
We didn't send it by mail. We sent it by UPS. Do they just deliver to the post office?
We have a little post office where we live, and everybody has a post office box. So the post office, or, you know, UPS, I don't know. You know, now I just will have to go check. I just know I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, well, in any case, I think
because that's a while ago that you sent it, so it should be here by now.
That's what I thought. I mean, I know the holiday weekend, but UPS is having, I mean, the hardest part of the pandemic in terms of book selling is the supply chain. We had an amazing incident yesterday in which a very famous author who lives here decided to promote a book. And we got, I will look, but well, last time I looked, our 1,000 book order had disappeared, and the publisher is panicking because they're going to have to reprint or extend their original print run in order to make it work as fast as it can. But, you know, it's a bizarre situation to be in, where you may have to turn away orders because you simply can't get the books. It isn't that people don't want it, it's that we can't actually get our hands on them. And I'm not sure how that's going to play out.
Yeah, when you were saying about the supply chain, I mean, my editor has been telling me, I mean, she had another one of her authors where the book was being printed. The factory ran out of paper, they shut down, I mean, whatever it was, but they had to send a truck to that factory, pick up the half finished book, and take it to a whole other factory to finish. And that, you know, there are issues with paper. their issues with binding. You know, factories also can't get what they need, but also because in any factory, you know, you have people close together. So they've had to shut down for various reasons. And I've been hearing more and more about just the getting books printed has become really difficult.
It has become. The two major printers are both in bankruptcy, and that is causing a huge problem. The paper problem began with the Trump tariff to Canada, and it became more profitable for wood pulp people to send it to furniture than to turn it into paper. Mm-hmm. So the paper shortage has been a problem for quite a while, but now there's just not any printer capacity. So a lot of books that were scheduled to come out this month, for example, have already been moved to November and December and into next year because of the manufacturing issues. And then we have a completely overburdened shipping system. So, you know, it used to be that we would get a whole order, despite the number of cartons in it, from UPS in one day. And now they trickle in. We sent some books to an author in Chicago, in Milwaukee, to sign. And time went by and time went by and nothing was happening. And then we discovered, and you can't really track them, that the post office had had these books sitting in Chicago for 2 weeks. And, you know, so thanks to Mr. DeJoy and his destruction of shorting machines and sorting machines and so forth, you can't even trace books. And so all books, you'll love this, all the packages we ship here in Scottsdale are now trucked to Los Angeles to be processed. And so it's taking, and while they're in that, we can't find them. So we have customers saying, where is my book? And we can't locate it because it went off to Los Angeles where it disappeared into. So that's been really frustrating, you know, for us and for them, is that not only is the shipping taking forever, but we can't even track the books that we have sent. So I'm, you know, there are a lot of challenges at the moment in terms of the whole supply chain. And it's really hard for new authors, for example, to get. In fact, the reason I sent you 50 words for Rain, and I would like to do something to help this author, is it's virtually impossible for, you know, for an author to get much in the way of traction. She had a great review in the New York Times, which I can send to you. Although I sort of feel like if you're going to read a book, you shouldn't read all that stuff. You should read the book.
I much prefer to read it without the review. I actually did an event like that with a debut author with Romans Bookstore a couple of weeks ago, Romans in Pasadena. And, you know, she had a whole, I mean, she's British. I mean, well, she's born in Singapore. She sounds pretty international, but she lives in London. And I guess the book came out there and I think did pretty well there and then was coming out here. They had a whole tour planned for her. The pandemic came. Not only did that come, but she also got COVID herself and is one of those long haulers and has been really pretty sick for a long time. But I read the book first and then I read the New York Times review and I thought they didn't read the same book that I read. You know, or it was a very... I mean, of course, every time you read something, right, it's just where you are in your head at the moment and what you know about life and, you know, how much have you traveled and just all, there's so many factors that go into how we interpret a book. But whoever had done that review, I just was like, this, you just read a completely different book than I did.
Well, that's also true of customers we have found over the years. You know, that, I mean, I've watched people standing at the checkout counter engaged in serious debate. I told Scott Turow, because we did his launch for his last book, that years ago, because he wrote Presumed Innocent shortly before we opened The Poison Pen. And I remember people standing, you know, to check out and actually arguing over who did it, because his was really the first of those kind of unreliable narrator or, you know, domestic suspense engaged in a legal thriller. And the science was a little tricky for people. And so, you know, I would listen to raging debates about, you know, no, it was him, no, it was her, whatever. And people came away with very different reactions to the book, depending on, you know, how they read it. So when I get books is, you know, I used to actually complain that I had too many advanced reading copies and I couldn't manage them in my office, and now I don't have nearly enough. So I'm getting a lot of PDFs, which I can't read digitally and remember anything. I have an eidetic memory, which means I have to see it on the page or I can't recall it. So, you know, and I've been interested at the publicists of some really famous authors who just casually sent me the PDFs. And I thought, with one, I thought, you know, I could just put this up for auction and, you know, retire, fund the bookstore. Not that I need to. I mean, it's a not-for-profit anyway, but I was impressed that there was this degree of trust, you know, that they would send me a copy that could be shared. And initially, I have not done that. But in the days when I got lots of ARCs, they would always come with helpful things from publishers about, you know, how to read the book and what people were saying about it. And I always stripped it all out and threw it away because I never cared. You know, the only thing that mattered to me was how I read the book.
Right.
And then, you know, would react to it. And that would determine events that we would agree to host or book clubs that we would, you know, pick a book to belong to or whatever. And I adopted the non-review as the most negative review that we could come up with. Why waste time panning a book or causing a problem? You know, the easy thing to do is if I didn't like it, we just didn't review it. And I'm doing that right now with all these political books. You know, we are a politically neutral bookstore, loads of bookstores with missions, but we are not one of them. And so you can order any of the pro or anti-Trump or Biden books from us, but we religiously do not list them, do not review them. And frankly, I don't really even want to read them, but there we are.
We were talking about this just the other night, like who buys all those books, you know? Well, and how could you keep reading? I mean, if you think about how many sort of Trump tell-alls there have been, I can watch the 5 minutes on the news and hear what was in it, and then I don't have to know anything more. But it's bizarre. I mean, I thought that it was interesting what's her name, Mary Trump, that her book had sold what 900,000 copies in the first week. And I was like, who are those 900,000 people who need to read that particular book? Maybe it's wonderful and very insightful. I don't know, but I don't want to read those books either.
No, I don't either. Although your publisher should be really grateful for them, since, you know, it's like
my publisher, you know, their position. What was it that I was talking to Nan Graham, who's the publisher for my division there of Scribner, and she had said, what was it? We're trying to publish the first draft of history. And I was just like, okay. I mean, I understand the idea, but that, I think that would be hard over time.
I do too. I agreed to do an event for a biography of John McCain against the objections of some of my staff. And I said to them, I'm not viewing this as a political event. He was a great soldier. He was a statesman. He was a great Arizonan. We did events for his books before he ran for president. We did, because he published several books and we host. I said, how hypocritical would it be for us now to say, no, we don't want to host John McCain, after we did host John McCain. But I think it'll be interesting to see.
But I think that's different because, again, he was from Arizona, so identified with Arizona, you know, I mean.
Right. I mean, you know, my point is that
being a politician.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see whether it turns into, I mean, I'm going to make a point of saying this is not a political event. This is a book, you know, honoring John's, you know, terms of service, because he did a lot of amazing things. Anyway, in a charged political climate, I'm not sure that one can do or say anything that doesn't have repercussions. So, you know, you have to do what your conscience guides you to do and accept the fallout. So, you know, that's what we're doing. Well, this has been fascinating. I miss you. We've been together for all of your books.
I know. I miss you too. And I have to say, I did go out on tour for 5 days for the paperback of Island of Sea Women, and it was 5 states, you know, however many airplanes in 5 days, and then the tour was canceled. It was pretty weird to be out there. This was still early, you know, in March. Yeah, it was strange, but I know a lot of authors don't like to tour. I've always liked to tour. I've always loved to be able to, you know, come and visit you, and we've always had good dinners, really good dinners, and good events. And I miss that. I miss seeing, being in bookstores. I miss seeing and talking to readers and people who love books. I really miss that. And so this has been fun, you know, even though we can't be together in person.
Well, it has been fun. And perhaps we can do an event together in October. We'll see how it works after you read the book. And perhaps by the time your finished book comes out, we'll be able to do something in person. We're actually going to try we have an author driving in from Los Angeles who is just so fed up with being at home, she's determined to come. You know, revisit the Ballyho and, you know, all the rest of it. And so I've seen a number of events staged outside, you know, where the author is masked up and the fans are. And so we can easily do that. And
you can do that where you are. You just, of course, not in the heat of the summer, but a good part of the year, you can do that in other places.
Yeah. We can. At the end of September, if it's really hot, we can put her in the very back of the store and open all the doors. You know, mm-hmm. And we bought ultraviolet lights to sanitize the store every night. You can't be in the store when the lights are running, but we purchased a number of ultraviolet lights to completely sanitize the store every night. And I think that we can do a very nice event in the overhang, and people can socially distance in the parking lot, and, you know, and we'll see how that goes. I don't know whether we'll ever be able in the next couple of years, be able to return to, you know, the whole bookstore bursting with fans. I think we'll have to have a vaccine that everybody feels safe with, and that it's certainly not going to happen by November 2nd. And I'm not going to be first in line to try it, but I do think that in the next...
First it has to work and be safe. And they have to manufacture it, and they have to get it out there. And there are a lot of people in this country and a lot of people in the world. And of course, all the anti-vaxxers who I think on top of just being anti-vaxxers are going to be very nervous about this particular vaccine, given the speed at which it's being developed and how it's being developed and technologies that we haven't put into ourselves before. So I think it's going to be a long haul.
I do too. But I think maybe the outdoor signing may be a solution that a lot of people can live with. And then we can always do the interview in the store, you know, in video or not. So anyway, it'll be kind of a test case, and we'll see. I feel like in this pandemic, if you can operate 1 month ahead, it's a really amazing thing. And there's no point in sitting here in September and speculating about next March, because we just don't have enough data.
We were just talking about Christmas and what we were going to do for Christmas. And it's like, we can't even think about that yet, because we don't even know where things will be. So you're right. I think a month is very ambitious. We're sort of more in 2 week increments.
Yes, to a great degree, we are too. But anyway, things are going very well, and I'm so pleased that we've had some time together. Thank you for sharing.
I'm so glad. And don't forget to send me the names of those books and also the show. And I have the one written down already, so that will be next up.
All right, I will do it, and I will talk to you again soon. Bye. Okay. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.